Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. We've got a very fun, very special conversation coming your way today with one of our favorite guests, Philadelphia radio talk show host Joe Stazek from 97.5 The Fanatic. We're going to be talking to him about a wide-ranging basketball agenda, the Villanova National Championship, and the coup in the Philadelphia 76ers front office, which just claimed their general manager, Sam Hinkie. And again, this is all hot breaking news coming out of Philadelphia over the course of the last week or so, as far as talking about all these things going on. Philadelphia sort of the epicenter of hoops at both the college and pro levels right now, and for radically different reasons. When you look at the college level, again, you're looking at the epitome. You're looking at a team that has just won the national championship. When you are looking at the pro level, you are talking about the epitome of failure and sadness, again, at least in the short term. Sam Hinkie had a system that he always kept kind of falling back on and pointing to, and ultimately he lost the internal support that he needed to take things further. So the Colangelo family looks like they're going to be now sort of full bore at the forefront here. Jerry Colangelo has been in town. Brian Colangelo looks like he's on his way. So we're going to find out what comes next and what the people of Philadelphia are saying about this, about the extreme amount of success at the collegiate level and the extreme amount of failure at the professional level, again, as it has been spelled out the last couple of years anyways. And in fairness to Sam Hinkie, his system always called for short-term extreme failure. Just because what we've seen thus far has gone the way that it has is not necessarily in and of itself an indictment of what he has done, but we're going to be talking about the complicating factors that go into that. And again, I can tell you, as somebody who experienced sort of the same kind of a thing around the turn of the century here in Cleveland, the very determined effort to tank to get LeBron James that ultimately was successful. Again, there are pluses and minuses that go with that. And people kind of forget that the team had to be rebuilt around LeBron completely in his first 2 years. We tend to forget that. We tend to kind of gloss over that. And indeed, there's some revisionist history where people look at it and they wonder and they go, well, how come it took 2 years to make the playoffs when they had LeBron? It's because they had to tear down everything that was around him. Because even a talented player like Ricky Davis, you had to get rid of him. People outside Cleveland may or may not remember this, but Ricky Davis, a very talented player, he will always be best known in this town for trying to get a triple-double by firing a basketball off the other team's backboard, thinking he could get his 10th rebound. He actually did this. He thought it would count if he intentionally missed the other team's hoop and grabbed a rebound. Unfortunately for him, it does not work that way, but it's that extreme emphasis on the stat sheet and on all things personal and selfish that ended up, again, that was the culture that kind of grew up around the team at the time that they were tanking and failing enough to get LeBron in the first place. Much the same thing has been happening in Philadelphia. Of course, the process of tanking and failing has taken longer in Philadelphia than it did in Cleveland, because in Cleveland, it was only an all-out effort for 1 year to tank to get to LeBron. There was one player targeted. He'd been on everyone's radar for a minimum of 2 years. The Cavs tanked, got him successfully, and I say as a Cavs fan, all things considered, thank God that we did. For the 76ers, it's just been for the last couple of years. Keep tanking, keep trying to get high picks, figuring that the law of averages will work in your favor at some point or another. And that has been the general assumption. That has been the way that everybody kind of thought that it would go. And again, to this point in time, there has demonstrably been a culture of failure around this team. There has been an atmosphere that has not allowed these young players to thrive and succeed, and it has led to young players like Michael Carter-Williams getting cast off already, getting moved elsewhere because they were deemed not to be developing sufficiently in the system. A high-caliber blue-chip young player like Jahlil Okafor from last year's draft, already, again, in some ways, I won't say damaged goods, but diminished goods in terms of his first year of fitting into the NBA. More problems off court than on, really, although he's not probably progressing on court either at the pace that some would hope. A guy like Nerlens Noel, he's going to be a high-caliber defensive star. He's somebody who, you know, if you get really, really, really lucky, he has the career of a Dikembe Mutombo or similar type player, but certainly didn't have the offensive game to be drafted and have those kind of hopes put on him for being drafted very high, that's for sure. And what more needs to be said about Joel Embiid, who set back the system, the process, whatever you want to call it, in Philadelphia by being, I would say, the Sam Bowie of this generation, but that's not even remotely fair to Sam Bowie, given how long he managed to linger at the NBA level, not star at the NBA level, but linger at the NBA level. Sam Bowie goes down in legend because Michael Jordan was passed over for Portland to take him. We tend to think of Sam Bowie as a guy who never played a game in the NBA, but he's a guy who lasted over a decade in the league, just was never the high-caliber star player that a lot of people thought he would be coming out of college. Joel Embiid is looking a lot more like, again, I would say Greg Oden, except, again, Oden at least had a cup of coffee in the NBA, at least showed what he was capable of doing before he broke down. Embiid is a guy, and I go back to the summer of 2014, I was screaming my head off for the Cavs not to take him. I won't pretend that I had any idea that the Cavs getting the first pick, which they ended up using on Andrew Wiggins and then in the trade to get Kevin Love, I had no idea that was going to be the first domino to fall to get LeBron James back in town. But I wanted a high-caliber impact player with the top pick, and Embiid was somebody that scared me to death. Big men, bad feet, we've lived that in this town. Zydrunas Ilgauskas is actually somebody who kind of defied the odds and went on to have a nice, long career. Maybe not at the level people were thinking when he was drafted in 96 because of the foot injuries, but again, somebody who was able to contribute a lot and be a solid, outstanding player for a long time with this Cavs team, notwithstanding the bad feat that he had ended up overcoming in his career. But big men who overcome that are rare. They are few and far between. There's something about the growth pattern of guys who grow up to be that big, that tall, the bone structure, the feet can be very, very problematic. The Cavs, fortunately, I say as a Cavs fan, did not overlook that with taking Joel Embiid. The 76ers, sitting there on the board at number three, I'm afraid did get greedy and look at that and say that we can't afford to pass him up. There's too much of a drop-off to the next couple of guys. So these decisions over the last couple of years with Sam Hinkie, we're going to be talking about that. I see we have our guests on the phone lines here. We're going to be talking again about the great success of Villanova basketball very recently and the short-term failure of the Philadelphia 76ers that was anticipated by one and all, but has led to what some have said is the premature exit of general manager Sam Hinkie. Villanova and Philadelphia 76ers, two sides of one coin in basketball, to be sure. So we're going to get to that here. We'll just reset for everyone. Welcome, everyone, to the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. We have with you today one of our favorite conversational guests here, our good friend Joe Stazak from 97.5 The Fanatic in Philadelphia. I have been honored to be on his show and be talking about him, talking with him on various great sports topics. Today we're going to be speaking with Joe about the great success of Villanova basketball. Today we're going to be speaking with Joe about the great failure, short term anyways, of the Philadelphia 76ers. But it's always a pleasure to be able to get Joe Stazak on the line with us. Glad to be able to bring him in. Joe, how are you doing today, my friend? Good to have you back in the FDH Lounge, sir.
Hey, Rick. Long time no talk. How are you? Great to be back. Having a pretty good week here in Philadelphia for once.
Absolutely, yeah. Let's go with Nova here. Let's talk about that. Congratulations. I will tell you, it was a much better ending to the game for you than it was for me. I was in one of these pools where you draw teams randomly at the beginning, and then you can pick up other teams based on who covers in the game. I ended up inheriting North Carolina part of the way through the tournament. That ending cost me 200 bones. I was shrieking at the TV before I turned it off in disgust amidst all the confetti. Safe to say, your reaction, I'm sure, was a lot different than mine.
Just a little bit. And first of all, my condolences. I've taken bad beats. I've been on the other end of shots like that. Trust me, I feel your pain, Rick. But being a graduate of Villanova, and it's been 31 years, and I honestly thought I'd probably never see another one. It's not, you know, Nova's a good program, but not quite top tier, Kansas or Kentucky or Duke or Carolina. But to put another ring in the jewelry box, I think legitimizes the program, and I just think that it's not the David story that it was in 85. It wasn't Goliath either, but they were the number one team for a couple weeks this year, and they really, really, really flipped a switch when it came tournament time, and they had that look, and that they were on a mission, and they were going to do something special. So I was surprised that they beat Oklahoma by 44 points. I think anyone tells you that they predicted that would be lying. But I wasn't surprised that they beat Carolina. Surprised they dropped that 10-point lead with 4 minutes left. But it could have gone either way, to be honest with you. I wasn't overconfident. I wasn't going in with a pessimistic point of view. I thought they had a shot at beating Carolina if they can play the defense like they had been playing. And they really, you know, Jay Wright, to his credit, he got his players to buy in to play defense and to be about each other and be completely unselfish. And they took away Perry Ellis with Kansas, 4 points, five shots in the game. Buddy Hield had 37 in his previous game against Oregon. He had 9 points, one of eight shooting from three against Villanova. And, you know, they outscored Carolina in the paint big time, despite being out-rebounded by 13 points. And, you know, they got Cayunes. You know, they have a devastating, ridiculous bicycle kick in the air, double pump, left-handed Marcus, you know, Page, three-point bomb to tie the game, and all the momentum's on Carolina's side. So you know if that clock goes to zero and it goes to overtime, the momentum's in Carolina's favor. But, hey, they came down. Arch Diacono made the right read, and Jenkins, who didn't have a great game, but he was there when it counted and just stroked it. I mean, it was kind of a very, very fitting ending to a great run.
It certainly was a lot of momentum for Carolina at the end there, and I needed them to cover the 2.5, so I figured if they even got the overtime, my odds were pretty good. As my dad pointed out to me, I still got 100 instead of the 300 that I would have won, but you know, you being a great broadcast veteran, Joe, you know this. Anytime you at least get a story for the show, there's some consolation in it there. I managed to crack you up with my bad luck, so that gives me something, anyway.
You know, it's funny. We doing the radio business, and I appreciate the kind words, Rick, but the Eagles had a disastrous season. Disastrous season. But you always looked at the silver lining. As bad, the worse it got, the better the storylines. So the silver linings I would take out, I'd be like, yeah, but it's, you know, it's going to be a good story. I would tell my partner, he's all throwing stuff and breaking stuff. I'm like, yeah, but we're going to get a lot of calls tonight, right? He's like, yeah, I guess we'll have a good show because of it. Just the way it works.
That's one element of it. And I have to say, too, and I'll for these purposes, I will use the PC abbreviation. But speaking of the Eagles, I have to say some great, great humor that I have been finding recently from your fan base there with the Eagles, this EDP 445 fella. I have just discovered him in the last couple of months. As I say, I'm abbreviating to be PC. But some of the funniest and best sports rants you will ever find out there. That guy is a true original.
Yeah, you're right. It's not really made for radio, but there's some interesting reads there that you can certainly find time to entertain yourself with. And I mean, that team, gives you plenty of fodder, let's put it that way. That team has more material than you know what to do with, and they just keep keep churning it out and churning it out. And, you know, with this town, this town could take, you know, positives and turn it into rants. So, either way there, I mean, this town pretty much churns out drama and storylines after storylines. I mean, this whole week, you know, there's Villanova. And then there's, the Sixers, the interesting exit of Sam Hinkie, and then the Flyer. Not that this, you know, we look for these kind of stories, but Ed Snyder passed away today, the owner of the Flyers and the founder of the Flyers, and it's going to be Eagles draft coming up, and, you know, the Phillies home opener today. And you know, for what it's worth, all the teams pretty much stink, except for the Flyers. They made a run. They got into the playoffs. You know, that's a good little story there. But we're hanging on to little victories. Making the playoffs, you know, playing the Caps, okay. But they made the playoffs. They made a nice little run. It's a little bit of a surprise. But I think Nova was really kind of uplifting for the city, even if you weren't a big Nova fan, because they're kind of vilified in the city. They were one of the big five teams, and, you know, Raleigh Massimino kind of went national back in the day, kind of broke up the big five. I'm talking about Temple and St. Joe's and Penn, LaSalle. You want to throw Drexel in the mix. People still have hostility like 40 years ago for something Raleigh Massimino did. So you either love Nova or you hate him, but I think the people in the middle, the team kind of embodied what Philadelphia really longs for in a team, and the grit, the hard work, and the defense, and, you know, playing together and coming together and playing for each other. And so it gave the city a little bit of a boost this week. Had a nice parade last Friday, big crowd, and just the way they got it done, I think, turned some people who weren't necessarily Nova fans otherwise.
Absolutely. Again, and as you mentioned, a great heritage with the Big Five, the Palestra there in Philadelphia.
Right.
With an amazing, great tradition over the years. And there's so much to unpack off of what you've said already about this. But I want to harken back to one of your earlier comments when people are talking about David and Goliath a little bit. Although, as you said, it wasn't really the case. They were a one seed. They're a highly ranked team throughout the year. But for anybody looking at this, and again, and this is sort of an extreme kind of a take, if anybody goes, first mid-major team since Texas El Paso in 66. I mean, where does the Big East stand on the landscape these days? I sort of have a hard time getting a handle on that. It doesn't necessarily seem fair to call them an outright mid-major, but this isn't the Big East we grew up on either.
No, not. I don't even know who plays in the Big East anymore, to tell you the truth. I have to go back and check. Wait. Where's Louisville these days? Wait, where's West Virginia? Wait, they're not. Wait, Syracuse is what? It's like it's completely, completely changed from. I don't know if you saw there was a 30 for 30 on ESPN Requiem for the Big East. It's just phenomenal. You know, back in the days with like Pearl Washington and Chris Mullin and those battles with Cuse and St. John's and Patrick and the Georgetown teams and Stu Granger and Eddie Pinckney, and I mean that was the Big East. That was Big East basketball. You know, that was very physical, very hard nosed and defensive style of ball and. With the rivalries and the hatred for the other teams, the respect but hatred at the same time, sports hatred. It's just not what it is today. It just isn't. But Nova's still, you know, I guess representing a little bit. And I don't know if, you know, people from the Big East days or fans of the Big East back in the day maybe can find some solace, because I think it's really, and I get it. It's all about the Bucks these days, but it's just not the same with everyone, you know, basically hightailing it, you know, for the Bucks and changing conferences and just completely realigning everything. It's just not the same. The rivalries have changed. You know, that hatred for that team you were usually used to playing twice a year, maybe you'll see them in the conference tournament, and it's just not that anymore. It's just not, unfortunately.
Absolutely. Oh, that's right. You know, when you go back to the glory days of the conference, and you mentioned, again, the man who really elevated this program, got the national title, Raleigh Massimino in 85. It's one of these interesting things. you and I have talked about previously, every once in a while when we can find a sort of nexus between your town, Philadelphia, my town, Cleveland, I will tell you, Raleigh Massimino's second act at Cleveland State University went about as well as Jerry Faust's second act in the college game at Akron, which is to say not well at all.
Tell me about what happened with his stint at Cleveland State, because he kind of disappeared off the radar after UNLV, and now he coaches in Florida somewhere. It's, you know, I don't even know what team he coaches for now, but he's down in Florida doing his thing. I mean, that's 31 years ago since he won the title, so he's getting up there in age. How did the Cleveland State experiment go?
This is all hearsay, so I feel bad even saying this, but okay. The word around town is that he was just, like, blatantly mailing it in. It was just basically for a paycheck that he regarded it as a chance to sort of get paid in retirement.
Oh, my,
wasn't
really?
Wasn't hitting it hard as far as recruiting or anything else. I mean, that, again, I personally have no opinion one way or another because I don't know and I'm not close to the situation. But
sure.
That's the conventional wisdom on the North Coast. So, yeah, it's, you know, so sometimes, you know, when you get a name, all that glitters is not gold. And we kind of found that out the hard way.
This is true. I mean, yeah, he rose to stardom, and you know, that's interesting. I'll have to do some checking on that, and I'll get back to you on that. I'm gonna have to start digging in on that. I know, you know, he had his stint in UNLV, certainly quite a drastic change in personality from the Shark, you know, back in the early 90s and whatever, Jerry Tarkanian. But Raleigh kind of, you know, he surfaces tournament time, but really he's kind of disappeared from the map here in Philadelphia, but certainly not forgotten. I mean, there's still, you know, a lot of memories and a lot of, you know, every time the tournament rolls around or something on Villanova, you see that shot of him hugging his staff at the end of the game when Jensen got the ball into Dwayne McLean, time runs out on Georgetown and whatnot. But and I was glad to see him. I was glad to see him. I saw on ESPN on Sunday morning between the games, the semifinals and the title game, that he was back home in Florida taking care of his wife who's sick, and he said he wouldn't be at the game, but he'll be watching it on TV. Well, I turned on the pregame Monday night, and he's sitting on a set right outside of the you know, NRG Stadium. So they somehow, you know, got his butt to the game, and he was a lot more enthusiastic as it went on when he started talking about basketball and they were getting him going. And then as he was in the stands, he sat with Eddie Pinkney. It was nice to see. It was nice to see him back, you know, in the mix. A lot of the guys from that 85 team were at that game, and I had a few of them on my show. I went to school with some of them. I went to school with Harold Jensen and Mark Plansky and Eddie Pinkney. And, you know, so it was really, really fun. And I have them on, you know, when Nova makes some noise and they're in the tournament, and, you know, every year. But this year it was, I mean, it was unbelievable because, you know, now you can make comparisons, that run to this run, and you know, what did it mean for those guys and how has the game changed and whatnot. It was just a ton of fun right up until that shot.
Yeah, it's always nice to see when you have an old coach coming back and being embraced like that. I mean, I can liken that a little bit to in Columbus these days. I see Earl Bruce really being clamped to everyone's bosom down there. And it's nice because he was in a tough spot following Woody Hayes. Wasn't always fully appreciated, but, you know, all people remember later on are the good times, the good memories. He went out on a high note against Michigan. It's good to see Raleigh getting treated the same way with Villanova, people remembering that moment and treating it that way. But as far as the arc of the program in the years since, this is what I really want to get your handle on, because, again, the sense in recent years has been, I mean, we did our college basketball tournament preview a couple weeks ago, and I mean, obviously the one thing that came up with Villanova is, yeah, you know, having a great year, but how many times have we said that before? So, you know, I would imagine that there's gotten to be like a real chip on their shoulder over a period of time that probably had to help with motivation. And, you know, in a sense, they were sort of the team that nobody saw coming, even as a number one seed, because this has happened so many times before. So what, in your sense, was different about this run and different about this team that allowed them to blow past some of the earlier disappointments that they have suffered in the past and ultimately make it all the way?
You know, it's interesting that you say the team that came out of nowhere. I mean, they held the number one ranking for about 2 to 3 weeks. But you're right. No, I mean, yeah, it sounds funny, but you're absolutely right. People were asking me when they became the top team. It's the first time that Nova was AP number one since they had won the title April 1st, 1985 back then. So it was a little bit of a story, and they hung around until they lost to Xavier towards the end of the season. It was a nice little run. I thought the same thing, though. I mean, people were trying to goad me into talking about Nova and pumping my chest and whatnot before the tournament, or before the Big East tournament. And I said, yeah, I'm going to reserve judgment on this team because I've seen this movie before and I know how it ends. So I'm just going to hold off a little bit and see what we got and see if they can get past the first weekend because they've, you know, they've run into, you know, Mount St. Mary's, you know, North Carolina State. You go back to the Lapis and Kerry Kittle's days and, you know, losing to Old Dominion in the first round as a three seed in the first game and just losing to Cal and Tony Gonzalez back in the 90s. They haven't had a lot of success except for 2009 where they made that run. They beat Pitt. Scotty Reynolds goes end-to-end. They go to the Final Four and then get whacked by North Carolina. So I was like, all right, let's just see. Let's just see what we got here. And I think the combination of, you know, this isn't a program that really gets a lot of one-and-dones like Duke and Kentucky and whatnot. So you have a veteran team led by a very good and very very heady point guard in Arch Diacono. And they also had – it kind of all came together. And this team was not about statistics, not about points, not about getting – mine or getting ours. It was about, you know, winning. And one thing that they did I thought was interesting, and they must be brainwashed to or programmed to think like this. They never thought about actually winning games, winning tournaments, you know, winning conferences. It was about winning the play. All right, here's what we're going to do, and we're not thinking about big picture. Win this play, win this possession, you know, do this thing. They talked about, and Larry Brown would have been all over this, you know, talking about playing the right way. And at the end of the game, at the end of the day, look, you know, look up, see where the chips fall, and see how we did. It was kind of like that. It wasn't about the moment getting too big or the game to getting too big or the opponent. It was playing the right way, doing the things they were taught over and over and over again and executing. Having said that, you can, you know, a lot of teams probably approach things that way. They went unconscious when they got to the tournament. I mean, shooting 71% against Oklahoma, beating them by 44 points, and, you know, they whacked a very good Miami team. It was a three seed, very good guards led by Angel Rodriguez. They beat them by 23. They destroyed UNC Asheville fine. We expected that, a 15 seed, but they blew the doors off Iowa. You know, after the first three games, they had trailed by a total of about 46 seconds in those three games. I mean, they just ran away with things. And then, of course, they got tested by Kansas. They didn't shoot that well. It's only two field goals in the last 8 minutes. But they hit their free throws, very very focused, 10 for 10 at the line. And they played defense. They stopped their biggest threats, which was, you know, Perry Ellis. And then they go to Oklahoma, or they go to Houston, and they whack Oklahoma. The momentum kept building and building. But to shoot like that for the tournament, it's one thing to, you know, that perfect game against Georgetown, which will, you know, never happen again, where they shot almost 80%. But they shot 58% for the tournament, for the six games. One of them was a 71% percentage outing against Oklahoma. Their worst performance was against Kansas when they shot 40%, but made their free throws. They were 18 of 19 from the line, back-to-back games. So they did the little things. And they play defense. And really, when you get to the postseason, in almost any sport, it really does come down to defense. And because it turns into offense, and they really bought in. And I thought Jay Wright did an unbelievable job. I was glad to see him get the monkey off the back, at least advancing past the first weekend. I didn't necessarily expect him to win the title, but just the way they played, and they had that look. You know, once you start getting the confidence, and you can taste it. And I think they smelled it. And they had a guy, Arch Diacono, who had been playing 4 years, at Villanova, and they had Oshefu, who had an injury down the stretch, but he was getting healthier. They finally had a big, you know, and he's not Ralph Sampson, but, you know, he's very smooth and very agile and athletic, and he did an excellent job, you know, posting up against the bigs of the other squad, and just the way they game planned and the way they executed was just, you know, sensational the whole way, and they deserve it.
Well, such a great team in the cohesiveness sense. I wonder to whatever extent, when we look at them in the 2016 landscape, if we look at it and say they were the perfect team for this moment, because when we did our Final Four preview a couple weeks ago with Evan Roberts from WFAN, we were talking about that in terms of this is a weird year in college basketball. College basketball has been dominated over the last 12 years or so by the one and dones, the big star
yes.
power players. Ben Simmons didn't even make the tournament this year. Now, Villanova did dispatch Buddy Hield, one of the very few that you could find out there this year. But
yes.
in a year where you didn't have that kind of rampant star power, you didn't have that super team like Kentucky of 2012 or anything like that, it just seemed to be an odd kind of year in college basketball. Were they the right team at the right time?
Yeah, I think so. I do. There wasn't – if you looked and went into the tournament, there wasn't that one team that had, you know, that listen, you know, at those levels and the McDonald's All-Americans those teams bring in every year, you usually see one of those teams and say, wow, that's the team you don't want to play. There really wasn't one of those teams. If I had to pick, I would have thought, I thought Kansas was the best overall team heading into the tournament. They also have a history, though, of bowing out at the wrong time, not playing the right way in crucial moments, and not really they don't finish like they should with all the talent they get. So I like the fact that they were in Nova's region. You look at Carolina, good team all year, but, you know, they weren't one of the great Carolina teams. They were big. They could shoot from outside, but really they beat you, you know, down low. But it wasn't a team that you thought was a juggernaut, you know, heading into the tournament. You know, you look at everybody else was kind of just, okay. Oklahoma, yeah, you can say the Buddy Hield had some people around him, but it was really about Buddy Hield. And if you could stop him like West Virginia did in the conference tournament, I think they held him to 4.6 points, you can beat that team. And there wasn't really that juggernaut team, like you mentioned, that team Anthony Davis that led Kentucky to the title a few years ago. There wasn't one of those teams. And, you know, Villanova, you know, I always say this, the best team doesn't always win. The team that plays the best usually wins, and you just have to, you know, win a game of basketball. You know, play better basketball for those 40 minutes, and just Nova just really put it together. And talking about a team concept and the way a team plays, yeah, they were the best team. You know, at the end of the day, when you look back, they were the best team, clearly the best team in the tournament. And then that shot really capitulated what that run was all about. It was you talk about the perfect game in 85, this is probably the perfect run by a team in a long time because of how they dispatched teams, whether they were higher seeds or lower seeds or they had to face, you know, a top program. I mean, they knocked off two number one seeds, a two and a three. I mean, that's pretty good. That is pretty
good. No question about it. Congratulations to your team, Joe, because they proved they were the very best in this tournament. A strong point of contrast to the success of Villanova has been the Philadelphia 76ers the last couple of years. Now, that's been by design, and again, Sam Hinkie would be the first. He would say, look, we weren't trying to do anything in the short term, and by that standard, boy, did he succeed. But this is one of these things. I look at this, and again, this is one of these things where from afar, I have a little bit of perspective on this because it seems to me the moment that everyone is trying to emulate is what my Cleveland Cavaliers did in 2003. You tank successfully. You have the crown jewel fall in your lap, LeBron James. This has been a multi-year process because there wasn't necessarily one LeBron James to target, but the sense that
That's
we get
correct.
Enough high picks, one of these guys will turn into a transcendent star player and we'll be set. But it's one of these things where I wonder if this was his downfall because as I look at it, LeBron took 3 years to make the playoffs because you had to turn over the entire team by the time he got there. They all had a losing mentality. We didn't have any veteran leadership. You had guys like Ricky Davis bouncing a ball off the wrong backboard to try to get a triple-double because he thought it would count as a rebound. I mean, that was the mentality that we had here.
I remember that.
Yeah, you had to purge everyone and everything. And I look at the attitudes in Philadelphia the last couple of years and Jahlil Okafor, the sense that he is turning out to be not damaged goods, but diminished goods at least. Michael Carter Williams didn't end up sticking around. They ended up trying to flip him for something else. So was there just a sense in Philadelphia, and you combine in Joel Embiid maybe being a lost pick at this point, of just saying, where is the end? Is the end anywhere in sight? Was that ultimately the question that brought down Sam Hinkie?
I think the thing that ultimately brought down Sam Hinkie, it's twofold. And I talked to, I had Dee Lynam on last night on my show. She is the first lady of Sixers basketball. I mean, she's a daughter of Jim Lynam, used to coach Sixers and St. Joe's, and she does sidelines, works for CSA. Had an interesting chat with her last night. This was the plan, and this was it. Okay, this was the plan. No one should be surprised about tanking. And they all but said it. I know you can't say it, but they all but said it. We're going to stink intentionally so we can get better. It's like a tear-down house. You're going to tear it down to its foundation, build it back up. So there were people, you know, two factions. One was, this stinks. I can't stand watching this kind of basketball. And it is. It's bad basketball. But I keep trying to tell, give me a different route. Give me a better process to try to build this team back up, because since 1983 they only made noise in 2000 when they had a Hall of Famer Iverson and a Hall of Fame coach in Larry Brown with, you know, four other guys around him, and took them to the, you know, three games of the World Championship. Other than that, they have not been able to build a team by being mediocre, winning 32, 35 games a year. I'm okay with what they were trying to do, and still what they are trying to do, and right now I think they're set up nicely if they can execute those picks. But the thing is, I think, and from what I'm hearing and people I talk to, in terms of relationships, agents, players, whatnot, really didn't want to deal with Sam Hinkie. One, because I think he had a little Chip Kelly in him in terms of his interpersonal skills. It's fine. That's okay. But my thing is, well, of course no one's going to want to come here right now. The team, the 10 wins this year, they had 37 wins and they're 37 and 196 in the last 3 years. I get that, but that was the idea. So then they start the season 1-30, and they start getting pressure from the league. You know, Adam Silver, I know this for a fact, he said, hey, guys, listen, you're embarrassing the league. We need you to step up the process, because, you know, the catchphrase here is trust the process. Okay. Step it up. Do something about this. This is really now becoming an embarrassment. And then with Okafor getting into some trouble off the court, the trouble he had in Boston in a nightclub after a game, and guys were goading him, and someone pulled a gun on him here at a local establishment in Philly. It looked like the situation was getting a little out of control. In fact, they used the term that they use in college, lack of institutional control. It appeared to,
right,
to you know, that's the projection that this franchise was giving off. So at that point, Josh Harris kind of acquiesced and said, all right, we're going to do something about this, because, you know, Sam Hinkie, along with all the positive things he does, because I think he's a valuable asset to a basketball program, he may lack some of the things that he needs to do as a GM, and his GM responsibilities, like assuaging issues with the players and the coach and the fan base, because he always, you know, hid every year until the day after the draft. That's the only time you would ever hear from him. So he wasn't great with the PR. He wasn't great at massaging. He wasn't great at, like, managing people necessarily. But his thing was to create a situation where the Sixers would be in position to draft highly in a few years in a row and create future potential. And that's what it was about. But at the end of the day, Josh Harris, I think, took heed and said, all right, we have to maybe bring other folks in who might be able to do the things that Sam Hinkie doesn't do. I don't think Josh Harris wanted Sam Hinkie out of here, but at the end of the day, I don't think there was a way to do it where you bring in some other people and Sam Hinkie, the GM, the sitting GM, is going to be okay with it, because it's basically saying, well, we don't have complete faith in what you are doing. We're going to get you some help. And then the murmurs, you know, spread throughout, you know, the area about the, you know, Jerry Colangelo might be bringing in his son Brian Colangelo. And Sam said, you know what, I'm out. So that's what happened. I think he certainly has, given, he's bequeathed Brian Colangelo a lot to work with this year going forward. But I think Brian Colangelo is going to do what Sam Hinkie maybe did not do. He has good relationships around the league. People like to deal with him. He's got a good reputation. He was twice executive of the year. He will bring in, and this is what I think Sam Hinkie may have lacked, he will bring in some people, some players, who not only will help these kids learn how to play at this level, but how to act, you know, and conduct themselves. You know, it's not just about
right.
throwing lottery picks on the floor and someday hoping, you know, watering it and planting it and, you know, putting it out in the sunshine, hoping it will grow. They still need to be kind of helped along the way, and I think maybe
right.
Sam Hinkie missed out on that. And to become NBA players and young men, these kids, they're kids. I mean,
right.
I mean, just because they're 6 feet, you know, nine, and they've been, you know, on TV for 10 years, they're kids. They're 19 years old. They're 20 years old. They are still young men doing stupid things off the court and stupid things on the court, and they need some help along the way, and I think Sam Hinkie lacked in that.
Right.
But there was no way for it all to coexist, and so Sam said, you know what, it's time for me to fly.
Well, Joe, a last question in our brief two or so minutes remaining here. Do you get the sense that it could be possible cynically in terms of whether it be any of the minority partners who may not have been happy about the way things were going, Jerry Colangelo, whatever, of feeling like, hey, a lot of the heavy lifting's already been done. What's the harm if he ends up having enough and saying, I'm gone now, because he's left us with a situation that, again, will be beneficial somewhat? Could there be any sense to that? Of anybody feeling like he was disposable at this point because they'd already been through a lot of the worst?
You know, I think that's very possible. No one will admit that. In fact, Brian Colangelo, one of his job descriptions or job titles should be defense attorney for Josh Harris, because he took so many bullets yesterday that were being fired at Josh Harris from the Philadelphia press corps. He kept stepping in. Let me answer that. Because, I mean, Josh Harris might be a very good businessman, but he does not really – he's not very adept at the press conference thing yet, and he kind of went in with some stock answers and tried to, I think he went in thinking, I'll be able to dance around, you know, these knuckleheads. No, they tried to pin him to the wall on some of the things, and one of the things was, did it come to you, as a surprise to you that Sam Hinkie would leave when you're bringing other guys in? And he tried to dance and dodge and whatever. I think, though, yeah, you make a good point. Sam Hinkie has done a lot. He did a lot of the heavy lifting, a lot of the groundwork. Josh Harris is a very smart man. I think you'd be kidding yourself if you think that he thought it was all going to work. And I think that it certainly crossed his mind that, oh, if I bring in X, Y is probably going to leave. But at that point, he's put us and set the ball in motion and put us in a good situation where Brian Colangelo is capable of taking it from here. And I think that's what happened. I think the people in this town aren't upset with Sam Hinkie. They're not upset with the Colangelos. They're upset with Josh Harris the way it went down, because I think people, if you're on board with the process, wanted to see Sam Hinkie finish the job or see what this was going to be, you know, through the vision of Sam Hinkie. But I think the team's in good hands with Brian Colangelo. I really do.
I think so as well, because of the track record you've cited, past executive of the year history that he has. And again, when you talk about a good situation to be in, it is always exactly that when we have you on the show to discuss whether it be hoops or anything else. Joe Stazak, thank you so much for being on the show. You've always been a great friend to us. Thank you so much. Look forward to doing it again. Have a great week, my friend.
Hey, Rick, always a pleasure, my friend. Great talking to you. I'm going to have you on my show very soon, my friend. I'll talk to your people. And we'll make something happen.
You know where they're at. You're way too kind. I appreciate it, Joe. You're a great one. Thank you so much for being on with us. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to this mini episode of the FDH Lounge.
I appreciate